If we could revert back again, I'd just like to talk about your father and your father's time there. Now, was he, you know, before the war years, I mean, how self-sufficient was Jacobs?
Very, very self-sufficient.
In what way now?
Jacobs did everything for themselves. Jacobs did everything except mill wheat and refined sugar. They did practically everything else for themselves. They blended the flour and they got it for the various mixes. They made their own chocolate from raw cocoa beans. They did all their own ancillary work. Apart from baking and packing biscuits, they made the tins that they went into, the tin making plant, which meant those tins went out and they came back and they had to be washed, so they had a tin washing plant as well. And they printed the labels that went onto them. They had their own printing department. They had, when I went there, they had their own stables with horses in it. They were still using horse-drawn carts to bring things to the railway. That was all. For deliveries, they had vans, motor vans, which they built themselves. They bought chassis and they employed coach builders. This was the same craft as built railway carriages. And they built the vans, and then they had sign writers to put the letters on them employed. So they just built the vans on the chassis. They bought the chassis. As well as that, they had all their own maintenance. As I said, there was actually 16 unions in there dealing with all the different craft unions, because you got the fitters who did metal work, and then you got the sheet metal workers who worked with metal when it went beyond a certain thickness. And then I can remember the argument when Perspex came in as to who was going to handle that. And eventually it ended up that the carpenters handled it because you cut it with a saw. So there was a glazier for the windows, and there was a locksmith.
Really?
A full-time locksmith.
What powered the factory?
They produced their own steam, and they had standby generators. And during the 1950s, they went over from coal to turf. And they put in three turf-burning boilers. They put in one, and they found it was so efficient and saved them so much money that they put in another two. And they were that was groundbreaking engineering at that time as well.
Were you witness to that event during that time?
Yes.
How did they store all the turf, and where was it coming from?
I think the turf was coming somewhere in the Midlands, probably Newbridge. Port of Mona had a big place in Newbridge. It came in as milk peat. And it came in, I think, every day. There was a delivery every day of a big lorry load of it that was dumped and then went in as milk peat.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, and it was, that was partly because they didn't want to be dependent on imported fuels. They wanted control of it. It was about being self-sufficient. Mm. They were very self-sufficient. Now, they lost all that. That all changed, not so much while I was there, but after I left. I left in 1973, but after that, and with the move to Tala, they left an awful lot of their self-sufficiency behind because it was cheaper for them to buy it in.
But did they have a building outside, a gasometer?
But during the war, because gas was rationed, and they had a gasometer that I think they got from an old gasworks in Thomastown. Yeah. But my father told me that because he I think he saw it there and told him. They had a gasometer at the corner of Angel Street and Bishop Street and Peter's Row, and they stored gas there that they could use when the pressure went down in the main works. And that was there probably until early 1950s, and the bits of it were still there when I went there. That had been taken down and stored and became a car park. But of course the buildings, there were two tenement houses behind it, and behind that again there was a church which is now gone.
Mm.
But that was there on the corner for a long time, that round gasometer. That was their own.
And what did it look like? I mean, for a young lad, you saw it.
Well, I grew up in Dublin, and as far as I was concerned, it was there when you went on the number 12 bus, you saw it, and that was Jacob's gasometer. But it was probably only there from 1940 on. And it was a smaller version of the big one that was down on the docks, the one that they've now converted into flats.
That's right, yeah.
And it was a much smaller version of that. And a lot of country towns had gas companies.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly Wicklow had one. And a lot of town councils had gas works to produce mm-hmm. gas for light originally.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary story because, you know, you had, as you say, the factory was powered at the time by turf that was coming
out. Not with that gas, not during the war it wasn't. That was only in the 1950s that came in.
Oh, yes, but before that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to know that the turf, which was shipped up from the Midlands, you had all this self-sufficiency, you know, within the building. But all of that changed. But there were a number of people, I'm sure that we were talking about names a while ago, you know, you were called by, but I'm sure there were a lot of nicknames.
There were great nicknames in there, and seeing as you can't label dead people, I can name some of them. There was Wobbler Lynch, who was a great character, and one of the things about Wobbler is nobody could ever find out where he lived. We never had an address for him, because you went and asked him what his address was. He'd say, well, there's no point in giving it to you, he'll be moving. And we know he walked to work every morning, and used to appear from different directions quite often. And there was Mousie Connell. And he was called Mousie Connell because he was known for being a man who regularly forgot his lunch and would scrounge it from the others. And one day, they put a dead mouse between two slices of bread and gave it to him.
Oh.
Which is why he was called Mousie Connell. And then there was Black Man Bourne and Baller Wash. And, well, there were a few that I couldn't tell you. So there were a great place for nicknames.
Yeah.
But then Dublin was a great place for nicknames anyway. Sorry.
Yeah, yes. So was there, there are the names, but I suppose the women didn't have names, did they?
Well, I didn't have much to do with the women because it was controlled by the Women's Welfare Department.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have much to do with them at all. I knew them and came across them, but certainly wasn't really aware of it. And of course, there were no married women in there, because once you got married, you had to leave. There were a few widows, and there was, coming up to Christmas, you got a married woman's shift, came in the evenings, because for the Christmas trade, they would come in probably more September, October, November, and they were kept to themselves. I think they didn't want them mixing with the younger women. because they might, and it was said at the time, they might be talking about things that weren't quite right for young girls to hear about. And so that was the only married women in there. And up to, well, again, it was even in the civil service, it was up to the 1970s, that if you got married, you left. And certainly in Jacob's, once you got married, you left for the women, and that was it.
But that's in the marriage ban then was
it wasn't
it just
it was tradition rather than legal.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't legal. I mean, you could employ married women if you wanted to, but it was just tradition that the place, and it said it in the constitution, the place for married women was in the home. That was it. And you couldn't work women outside certain hours anyway. Because when Jacobs went out to shift work before the move, we had to have a shift work license to work women after from 10 o'clock at night to 11 o'clock at night, and from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the morning. You couldn't employ women without a license between 8 o'clock in the morning and before 8 o'clock in the morning or after 10 o'clock at night. And you could not employ women at night at all, because I ended up, before I left, as night shift manager. And I was training manager at the time, and I had to train men to do what had been traditionally done by women, because you could not employ women on night work at all.
And so 24 hours of the day the factory was going, and
only in the 3 years before they moved to Tala. And that was because to move the plant, some of it had to be dismantled, which meant the capacity was less. So they worked an extra shift to make up for it. And I was network manager at one stage. I was in there and I had 200 men on night work on 5 different floors.